Serve It Cold, Episode 5. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Hey, Donata. Helen, who do you think it is? It is not late. You're just getting back from working at the lake, ain't you? Have y'all heard about Narlene? I heard from Tomas down to the Big Star that she had gone off with who knows. And he said Johnny C. went by that cradle bar this afternoon to talk to Goat. Is Johnny going to find her?
Yeah.
He sure enough knows New Orleans from running with Big John Turner. You think he's gone up to the city? Who's that at the university he working for? No, Tomas didn't know either. Some professor, he thinks. But he says Sonny Richard, that works for Goat, took a heck of a beating from someone night before last. Probably drugs. So you hadn't heard if any of them university folks living at the lake hired him? Well, you work out there at the houses, Donata. I thought maybe you heard something. I know you see plenty. Ha, ha, ha. So they still putting on that evening show, huh? Why don't you call the police about all that nakedness and drinking? I bet there's drugs there, too. I just wonder if they know Bebop and Homer Blue. You're right. Why would those high-class white folks know anything about Crosstown? So, don't you think that Tomas down to the Big Star is a right fine little man? You know, is he married or got a woman? Oh, I never.
Tuesday morning, I rolled over and shut off the alarm clock 1 minute before the 5 o'clock alarm got its chance to yell at me, once again demonstrating my uncanny ability to sleep for a set amount of time. I could hear the drowsy sound of rain hitting the wall of windows on the old sleeping porch that is our bedroom. I quickly decided that it would be useless for old Blue to try to keep up with either the Jag or the Porsche. The azaleas would be mighty wet this morning, and hell, I knew where they were going anyway. I opted for another 30 minutes sleep. The smells of Tanzanian southern peaberry brewing woke me at 6:30. So maybe my sleep timing prowess is not actually that uncanny. As usual, Vera had risen, cleaned up the evidence of the previous night's fish taco bacchanal, fed the menagerie, exercised, showered, dressed, breakfasted, and left to open her store at 7 o'clock. Next to the coffee pot, I found my now-clean thermos, my now-clean travel cup, the much-coveted Visa card, and a New Orleans shopping list. It was looking like my 2-day campaign to get out of the doghouse was bearing fruit. Maybe. I managed the 104-mile trip to New Orleans with a minimum number of stops, considering that fall migration was just getting cranked up, and bright flashes of feather along the roadside just had to be investigated. I rolled into the city a little after 9. The freeway signs for the French Quarter point to routes that seem to be designed to totally confuse and scare tourists, while supplying a constant stream of victims for the lower echelons of the Desire Street drug enterprises. My approach this Tuesday was a bit different and designed to gradually leave the real mundane world behind while slipping into the alternate reality stream of this unique bend in the Mississippi. The process began when I-10 spit me off of dry land south of Slidell and sent me skittering across Blue Lake Pontchartrain on the twin spans among the slashing Forster's Turns feeding in the shadows of a structure. My next cue was the steep climb to the sky of the Industrial Canal Bridge. I rolled my windows down to the heady morning smells from the community coffee roasters far below as the entire city was stretched before me as I crested the arc. Only here can you see how the city is clearly defined by the water that surrounds it. In New Orleans, compass points are meaningless, while water is everything. Streets either follow the contours of the river were slashed between the river and Lake Pontchartrain. Instead of north and south, we have lakeside and riverside. Instead of east and west, we have upriver and downriver, also known as uptown and downtown. I took the Elysian Fields exit off I-10 and rode the great tangent toward the river along the border of St. Roch neighborhood, right into the heart of America's first suburb, the Faubourg Marigny. At Washington Park, I turned onto Royal Street, sharply angling through the oldest part of the Faubourg, across the grand boulevard of Esplanade, and into the quiet, orderly blocks of the lower quarter. Sour beer and bright spice smells, thick in the heavy air, WWOZ spilling Etta James out of old blues speakers. This route is like a long, deep sigh to me, and leaves me with the calm excitement of coming home. It had actually been a second home for more than 6 years. The snug slave quarters apartment on Toulouse had started out as a base of operations for the many cases Big John took in the city, but it became a refuge in Never Never Land for Vera and me. Big John had warned us not to get too attached to the city that Care forgot. Creedmoor? Care might have forgotten her, but passion is not. There are grudges in quarter that are 300 years in the making. Nobody down here tells the truth, because they done forgot what truth tastes like in the mouth. I eased on down Royal, my nerves tingling. It was hard to believe that almost a year had passed since I had been in the quarter. I parked in my customary garage on Iberville, lakeside of Bourbon, and dressed for the day. Black t-shirt, black mesh fishing vest filled with surveillance toys over that, an empty army green backpack over that. I fluffed out my beard, teased my hair, and put a battered green baseball cap on. I slid 2 rubber bands over my wallet, and put it into the front pocket of my grungy jeans, picked up my cane and walked onto Bourbon Street, exaggerating my natural limp. 9 o'clock is the perfect time of day to walk down Bourbon Street, its sidewalks freshly washed, laughter bouncing from bars half filled with morning regulars, rehashing their adventures from the night before with still sleepy bartenders. Small groups of fresh new tourists cautiously weaved around the sidewalk puddles, their wide-eyed stares providing more entertainment for morning drinkers in the shadows of the bar. At Conti, I bounced over to Royal, already sidewalk full with bustle from the cafes and galleries. Street musicians were already claiming spots for the day, and panhandlers were settling into their territories. Here, I could feel myself start to fade into the background. I was born a Mississippi redneck, but I've always thought that the quarter is my natural habitat. Only here could someone with my size and appearance blend in with the crowd. Where but the quarter could I ever successfully tail anyone? As I crossed St. Louis, I saw the first soap bubble skitter across the street toward Brennan's. Soon I spotted another. Then a little group swirled down the middle of the street. I found myself on autopilot, following the stream of bubbles down the block to Toulouse, around the corner and to the very door that hid our courtyard. I had rested my hand on the dark green door for just a moment when a voice from behind me exclaimed,
"Little John!"
I whirled around, bringing my cane up across my body defensively, to find a familiar figure holding a stepladder in one hand and a bottle of bubble soap in the other. "Tommy! You scared me out of 7 years' growth!"
"You're one to talk. I come out of my shop to find Hagrid trying to break into the courtyard. I think it may be time to start braiding that beard, child. Please tell me you're undercover, and you don't go around the streets of Catherine looking like this."
"Well, yes and no. Yes, I'm on the job, and, no, I'm afraid this is about what I look like these days. Do you think you could trim me up a couple times in the next few days?"
"I imagine I can find some scissors somewhere."
Tommy and his partner had run the hottest hair salon in Atlanta before they sold out to their biggest rival for a killing, and like so many others, moved to the French Quarter to become shopkeepers. I stood there, my hand still on the door for a moment, but Tommy beat me to the punch.
"You don't want to go in there, John. Mackenzie's Antiques bought the slave quarters and gutted them. They just extended their store right into the first floor and are just using the upstairs for storage."
"Gutted them? Those buildings were 225 years old. I was rocked by the news. I'd never even considered that our apartment would not be waiting for us whenever we managed to get back on our feet again. "What about the Vu Carré commission codes?"
"John, you know the true code of the quarter. Out of sight, anything goes."
"What about George?" George had been our downstairs neighbor in the slave quarters, a saucier in one of the big hotel restaurants in the quarter.
You haven't heard? George disappeared. About 6 months ago, he just didn't come to work one day. I went into the apartment with the police, but we really couldn't tell if anything was missing or not. You know that makes 5 people in this block that have disappeared in the last 2 years? 6 if you count Big John.
Count him, Tommy. You never can tell when he'll come walking back down this street.
That's right. Hell, I done see one ghost today. You!
Suddenly, I saw a bright yellow Porsche right behind Tommy, cruising down Toulouse, and instinctively ducked my face away from the line of sight. I quickly laughed out loud at myself and explained to Tommy, I just saw a car like the one that my target is driving and overreacted. Guess I'm a little bit rusty. Tommy turned to look with me just as the car turned the corner onto Chartres, giving me a perfect view of Latimer Grantham at the wheel. I'll be damned. It's them.
The yellow Porsche? That's a hot car.
I saw that the barriers were going up that would convert Royal Street into a pedestrian mall and outdoor concert stage until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Tommy, can we step inside the shop? I think they're trying to get to the Omni parking garage. They won't be able to go up Royal now. They'll come right by here again in 5 minutes. I held the ladder while Tommy filled the bubble machine. Then we walked into the cool recesses of his shop, NOLA USA. Tommy showed off his new finds in the New Orleans collectibles, while in my mind I followed the Porsche's progress, as Grantham was forced up St. Peter's by Jackson Square, forced to cross Royal by the barricades, forced to cross Bourbon because it's one way downriver, finally turned upriver on Dauphine, made the block to Toulouse, and headed Riverside again. I stopped Tommy in mid-sentence. He should be here soon. And there he was, indeed. But instead of the harried tourist impatient at the sheer contrariness of the quarter's street grid, Grantham had the Porsche gliding slowly along while both occupants scanned the sidewalks. For me? Had I been made in Catherine? I traced my steps in my mind and decided that it was just my natural paranoia peeking its ugly head up from my psyche. I felt better when the car crossed Chartres this time and turned right on Decatur to make the block to their hotel, the Omni Royal Orleans on St. Louis. I said my goodbyes and left Tommy and his bubbles. I ducked into Le Marquise on Chartres, grabbed my usual raspberry croissant and a tall café au lait from the incomparable barista Tsarin on my way to the courtyard. I found a shady corner and checked in with Vera, Gojo, and Goat. Catherine was indeed still there. Narlene had not come home, and none of her friends had heard from her. There had been no new charges on Goat's American Express that she carried. Sonny had remembered that Jerry Joachim used to live on Governor Nichols toward the river. That was in the area of the French Market. I headed in that direction, cutting across the open-air circus they call Jackson Square. I was walking down Decatur when I decided to stop by Margaritaville and get some background on Sonny. As I approached the club, I saw Steve standing at its door. I first saw Steve standing by the door of a Catherine dive called the Homestead more than 25 years ago. It's a habit he's been able to turn into a profession as the manager of Margaritaville. For Steve, door standing is an art, and by the time I saw him, he was watching me from over a block away. As I drew closer, he bent his head with a finger to his temple.
I sense a large stranger approaching on a quest to rescue a beautiful maiden.
He cocked an eye toward me to see if I were impressed yet.
A beautiful maiden of the famous Catherine Goat Clan.
Then he lost it and doubled over in laughter, extending a hand. So Goat called you?
Sonny said you'd be headed this way. I got nothing. Not that I'd recognize her. Sonny said she's been in here with Goat, but that was 3-4 years ago. I guess I wasn't paying attention.
You pay attention now. I handed him a picture.
Whoa, are you sure she's Goat Johnson's sister?
That's what Goat tells me, and I try not to argue with the man. Steve, I really walked down here to ask you about Sonny. Good people?
Sonny? Sure, he's tight. I mean, other than being a drunk, a fairy, a piece of point caddy shrimp-picking white trash, he's a great guy who can tear your arm off and cram it up your ass if you don't get along with him. Of course, Sonny's never going to be as good a club manager as me, but I'm not good at that arm-tearing stuff.
Yeah, it's good to know your limitations, Steve. I just needed some verification on Sonny. Thanks. I handed him my card with the cell number already highlighted by my crack research team. Keep an eye out, and save me a piece of key lime pie. I walked on into the shade of the French Market sheds. I bought a piece of fruit here and there, showing the pictures, taking my time and keeping my eyes open. People were friendly, interested, but nobody had seen Narlene. Then about halfway down the concourse, a young man selling green peanuts looked at the picture and said,
"Hey, that's Narlene Moore."
He took a look at my face and answered the unasked question.
"Our farm is in Sunrise. I know her from church. Is Narlene in trouble?"
"Well, she headed toward New Orleans Sunday afternoon and hasn't bothered to call her mother. What do you think?"
"Yeah, I'd say yeah, Narlene's in trouble, all right. Well, I saw her yesterday down in the jewelry section of the flea market. She was with a white dude that just looked sleazy. Of course, he didn't much like me either. Anyway, she seemed to be all right. It was just about this time, maybe a little bit earlier."
It was good to get a hit. Good to know that she was all right 24 hours before. I drifted on down the way to where the French Market flea market bulges out from under the concourse roof in a maze of booths, trailers, and handcarts. Trying to filter out the sounds, the flash and color, the distractions of the market, I picked my way through a crush of people, focusing on finding one particular person. After 30 minutes, I found myself standing on a curb, my back to the steady traffic on South Peters, looking back into shade of the concourse when the reflection of a yellow Porsche wavered across the glossy side of the park van in front of me. True to Big John's training, I turned around slowly, away from the direction the car was traveling, so that I could see the car after it had passed me. It was Grantham at the wheel. I'd been dead wrong. They had not gone to park at the hotel. Why would anyone spend more than an hour driving around the quarter in the heat of the day? Then all thought of the car was driven from my mind as I realized that Narlene Moore was walking down the aisle directly toward me. She was dressed in a shiny, off-the-shoulder purple top and miniskirt, 5-inch heels, club clothes. Maybe inappropriate dress for midday downtown Catherine, but this was the French Quarter, and the wake of stares she left behind her was all Narlene. I looked around for a place to hide, but realized that she was already looking at me. As she drew near, she spoke.
"Johnny C., I'm so glad I found you."
I looked around. "Oh, are you talking to me?" She blushed and bowed her head.
Okay, Mr. Speed. I am sorry that my outburst Sunday morning may have caused you any trouble or inconvenience."
She peeked up at me with tear-filled eyes and said,
"I really am sorry, Johnny C."
I put my arm around her shoulder, and only when I had actually touched her did I feel that she was really found, that I had her. "It's all right, Narlene, but please don't start crying or all these people watching us are going to skin me alive. Okay, first things first, have you talked to your brother this morning?"
"Yes, I just talked to him, and he told me you were looking for me at the French market."
"Are you hurt? Are you physically okay?"
"I'm fine, just tired."
"Are you in danger?" The tears did start rolling down her face. She tried to speak and failed. Shook her head and tried to speak again, and again failed. "Bad question. My fault. Is anyone after you right now?"
"No, he's still asleep."
"Great." I pulled my cell out and called Goat. "I've got her. She's okay. I'll call you back after we get something to eat." I hung up and turned off the phone. I turned to Narlene and explained. "I know that Goat wants to talk to you, and he wants to talk to you right away. But we need some time to decompress, right? Come on, I'll buy you a burger." We walked back to Margaritaville and let Steve bring us prodigious amounts of food. Conch fritters, jerk chicken, quesadillas, buffalo frog legs, bean soup, and finally Buffett's cheeseburgers in paradise. Narlene was ravenous and ate everything put in front of her, steadily and silently. We were just finishing the burgers when Steve arrived with two slices of key lime pie and a carafe of coffee.
"Look here, Jonathan, I did save you a piece, and I've got some Joe that even a coffee snob like you like."
"What is it?" He winked at Narlene.
"Why don't you just taste it and impress us? Identify it."
"Steve, I may be able to tell you what it's not, but there are hundreds of coffee varieties. The best I can hope to do is get the continent, even if I were a real coffee snob. But I'm a betting man. I'll bet you the check, double or nothing, that I can get the country of origin or a country bordering the country of origin."
"You're on."
I poured a cup, looked at its clarity. I put my nose low and breathed in the aroma. I added some sugar and a little cream, thereby alerting all true coffee snobs that may have been watching that I was an imposter, and took a long sip. It was as I expected, a mild, perfectly balanced cup of coffee. It could have been from anywhere in the Americas with sufficient altitude for premium coffee. Bolivian. I took another sip. Shade grown, high altitude. Steve, I think it may be organically grown.
Damn you, Jonathan. How in the hell did you do that?
Dumb luck, Stevie. Just dumb luck. Now please pass me that key lime pie, my good man. As Steve walked away, shaking his head, Narlene leaned toward me over the table and asked,
Okay, how did you do it? Can't nobody tell that much about coffee just drinking it.
Well, actually, some people can. They're called cuppers. But I'm not even close to being able. I just happened to look at Margaritaville's new website this weekend, and they were bragging about serving CC's Bolivian High Mountain Organic Coffee. Even so, I gave myself a cushion. I was betting that if I were wrong, Steve wouldn't know whether or not any country in South America bordered on Bolivia or not. There was a pause, and then a big smile gradually bloomed on her face. She started laughing and laughed for a long time, her posture relaxing with her laughter, laughing in relief rather than at my little bar trick.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com.